And just to recap from last week, so we finished chapter 38 last week. We looked at some examples in chapter 38 about how God uses imagery that's very similar to that which Job used, especially when Job was giving some of his initial complaints about his situation. When you think about chapter 3 and then again in chapter 9, and we referenced back and forth a little bit between those things, and I don't see that that's just a coincidence. I read that as when God's using the same type of imagery that Job is using, that it's God's way of directly responding to Job's complaints by using those same images. And those similarities between the two examples add meaning to what God is saying, I think. So, for example, you know, when God spoke of sustaining the constellations in chapter 38, I think he was referring back to when Job spoke about them in chapter 9 to make a point about how God is so powerful, who can turn him back, who can change God's mind on anything. So when God says, basically, Job, you don't know anything about what it's like to guide the constellations, I think he's inherently saying, Job, you don't know anything about what it's like to try to reconvince me or that I can't be convinced, right? Because that's how you use that example. So there were several examples like that. There was like four or five of them that we looked at. And then in the end of chapter 38, we see God using the examples of the lion and the raven as creatures that he cares for. And I think that seems to set the stage for chapter 39, because in chapter 39, we're going to have a bunch of different animals doing a bunch of different things. And really, you see that again in chapters 40 and 41. So most of God's remaining response is going to be talking about animals, interestingly enough. So I think it's pretty apparent that God is proving how he cares for these animals, and by extension, he cares for Job, he cares for us. But there's this other point that we'll spend some time looking at in chapter 39, that the behavior of some of these animals is quite kind of mysterious to man. And it's not always mysterious in the sense of like awesome and majestic, like, wow, how does that creature do what it does? But more like, why does the ostrich abandon her eggs? You know, things that don't make sense. So we're going to try to see what that's all about and try to work all that out to the best of our ability. So were there any questions or any comments you guys had that you formed after our class about chapter 38 before we dive into chapter 39? All right. So I'd like to go ahead and read the entire chapter of Job chapter 39, and I'll read into chapter 40 verses 1 and 2. I think that they connect. So Job chapter 39. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch and bring forth their offspring and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. Who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, to whom I have given the arid plain for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on him because his strength is great, and will you leave to him your labor? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young, as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, "Aha!" He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out the prey. His eyes behold it from far away. His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there he is. And the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." So now it's Job's turn to talk, after having gone through all these examples of the animals. So what is this all about? Why is God talking about these animals in this way? Well, we'll do the best we can to try to understand what he's talking about and why it's relevant to Job, why it fits. So again, it's not, what we just read is not just about how God's caring for these animals. I think that you can interpret that, and that's certainly there. He is caring for them. But the main focus, at least as I see it, seems to be more about how these animals are acting, like how they behave and what they do, like what they've been programmed to do. Like these are all the things these animals do. And you can't help but, like we alluded to already, but notice that some of this behavior is counterintuitive. Or it could be seen even perhaps as foolish. And I think that that's kind of the intended way we're supposed to see it, because that would make sense as to why God leads into his challenge to Job. Will a fault finder contend with the Almighty? So do we see problems with God's creation? And maybe here are some examples that we might go to. Some of the examples he used were, and you could look at this, and some very reasonable questions would be like the part about the wild ox. Right, why do some oxen serve men but others don't? Does that make immediate sense? Why only some? Or, like we talked about, why is the ostrich so neglectful of her own eggs? And it even says that God made her forget wisdom. It said God did that. He says, "I did that. I made her neglectful of her young." That's something God said that he did. Or why would a horse look forward to going into a battle? I mean, let's think about it. What does the horse have to gain from that? Right? I mean, the thrill of the battle, but it's putting itself in this tremendously dangerous situation without really any regard for its own safety, and it's not going to gain anything from it like a man would, because a man goes to battle for a reason, right? There's some purpose behind it. What's the purpose for the horse going into battle and looking forward to it? I don't have an answer for that. Or maybe another answer is, like, you think about these eagles that are talked about. Why do the eagles gather where the slain are? And why are they feeding their young with the blood of the slain? Isn't that kind of weird and kind of gross? Like, why couldn't God have programmed them to go eat berries or something? Like, why blood? Why do they gather where the slain are? And I don't have good answers for these things. But that's kind of the point. And what is the relevance to Job? Like, why is God talking about these things? Well, I read chapter 39 as God challenging Job, and really any man who would find fault with how and what he created, with how he created and what he created. And he's using examples that are kind of the low-hanging fruit. Like, here's some examples of, if you want to try to find fault with me, here you go. Here's some I'll throw at you. Does that make sense to you? I did that. I made them that way. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense to me. Yeah, Kelly?
I think the reason I read this is the point that part of the point God's making, and not that we're some type of I did this for the reasons that, to God speaking, that were right.
Yeah.
Because I made him do it that way. And there's no... Man is... I mean, he's dead. He's arrogant. Man, you touched on this point well several times. Think, well, we'll be able to figure out nature. Well, no, you really can't. It goes because God makes it go. There are some laws that obey us, but there are some things that we just don't... will not understand
exactly how it works. Yeah, and you know, it's a big deal because these kinds of things have led people down an anti-religious path. They see problems, perceive problems with design in nature, and they say, well, you know, what kind of God would create a being that would do this? You know, and I want to talk about that a little bit as we go. But it's interesting to me that God lays all these examples out, and then he doesn't explain it. He doesn't say, do you know why the ostrich does that? I'll tell you why. No, he doesn't give him the why, right? He just challenges him, like, do you know why? And Job, of course, I think we can imply his answer is no. I mean, you know, we can read that, and I don't know the answer either. I don't know why they do that. But I think that God is saying, I do things, and sometimes the things I do aren't going to make sense. And sometimes the things I do, I'm not going to explain. And I don't have a need to explain it to you. I can explain it if I want, but I'm not going to in this case. And of course, that ties back into the theme of Job very well, because at the end of it all, what did Job want? I mean, up until this point, what was it that Job was wanting to do?
I mean,
yeah, he wanted to talk to God face to face and present his case and hear God's side, which is basically, he was being careful about how he said that, but it's basically like, God, explain why you're doing this to me, because it doesn't make sense. And I can give you all my reasons why it doesn't make sense why you're doing this to me. So how are you going to answer that? That's how Job saw this playing out in his mind, right? So now we're getting an answer in a different way from God about how some of the things I do don't make sense, and I'm not going to explain it to you. I'm not going to explain it to you. And that's our reality. You know, that's our reality. God's going to choose to do some things that don't make sense to us. There are things that happen in this life that don't make sense. Like we've been talking about, things you can observe in nature. They appear to be counterintuitive. Why does it have to be that way? Like, what was God thinking when he did this, you know? And let's get into how this has become fodder for criticizing God. Because in contemporary times, especially in the last couple hundred years, but really, it goes back further than that. But really, in modern secular scientific times, a lot of people have looked at these things and they've scoffed at the idea of there being a God, or at the idea that God would have created something that seems strange or weird or foolish, that doesn't seem to make sense to us. Have you ever heard somebody bring up these kinds of criticisms toward God and use examples from nature to do it? I've heard of a few, and they kind of range from like the silly to the tragic, right? On the silly end, I've heard this one before. I've heard someone challenge that the human body's designed, because if God designed the human body, why would he make the parts of the body that dispose waste also part of its reproductive system? That doesn't make any sense, they say, which is kind of a silly example, but that's something real I've heard. A more serious example, a more tragic example, would be, why do young children suffer greatly and die from neurological or nervous system diseases? And I think when I hear something like that, my natural reaction has been to try to defend God. Right? I want to try to explain why. Like, why does that happen? But in the spirit of Job, and especially chapter 39, I mean, first of all, do I really have to? Do I really have to give an explanation for it? And is that the best reaction when someone challenges you with that? Is the best reaction to go to an explanation for why you think God did it? Because it may not be something God has revealed why it happens. There's lots of things in chapter 39 he's not revealed as to why it happens. And if I'm being honest, I don't know why these things happen. Let me just put that out there. I mean, I know the Bible talks about how this world became corrupted when man sinned. But if you're confronted with that much gravity of a situation where people are talking about innocent children who are suffering and dying, is it really going to be wise or helpful to say, well, that's basically our fault for eating some fruit? I mean, I know that the Bible presents that's why we live in a fallen, corrupted world, right? But that may intellectually explain why suffering exists, but it isn't persuasive, and it isn't helpful, I would argue, especially if someone's being sincere because they've gone through something like that. It's not helpful. And it doesn't explain why the results had to be so extreme, right? Because the other person could turn around and say, okay, I get that. Man sinned. Okay, let's assume that what you say is true. Man sinned. Now we live in a fallen state. Why couldn't God have just given every person their own chance? Why do we all have to suffer? Why did he decide that we would all suffer for the actions of these two people? And do we have a really great answer for that? I don't. I mean, again, I could build an intellectual answer from Scripture, but I don't have a really good, satisfactory answer for those things just from the perspective of explaining why God did this. Right? That part of it is veiled to me. So, again, I'm not saying we can't deduce sound arguments from Scripture that do answer these challenges intellectually, and we've discussed some of that in the course of this class, especially at the beginning. I'm just trying to say, like, when we're confronted with this stuff, maybe we could think about putting this intellectual side of ourselves on the shelf for a minute. And just admit that we wish it weren't the way it is sometimes. I wish that children wouldn't suffer from these things. Can we say that? I wish it weren't that case. And where you're going to have to get eventually with someone who's genuinely trying to seek truth about our existence is you're going to have to get them to the point to where they also believe that God doesn't want that either. That's where you want to be. But explaining why he allows it right off the bat, because you've got an intellectual answer, probably isn't going to be very helpful. So the reason I'm pushing this approach, that maybe we could just admit that we wish it weren't this way and that we don't have all the answers, is because I think we're supposed to learn from how God is challenging Job and his friends here. And what he's challenging them to do first is accept the reality of your situation. This is the way I made things. Okay, accept first the reality of your situation. Don't wish for something, some existence that isn't real, where you had the power and ability to change things that don't make sense to you, because that's not your reality. You don't live in that reality. You can't create that reality. You're living in what I created, God is saying to Job. And the implication for us and what we've seen in Job is things are going to get rough. Things can get really rough. They can get rougher for some people than others. And yeah, some of that could be God's allowance. He's allowing those things to happen to some extent. And it may not make sense. We may not get an answer as to why those things are happening. But first and foremost, this is our reality. And in accordance to this book of Job and God's arguments to Job, first and foremost, he doesn't owe us an explanation. That's kind of hard to swallow right off the bat. But he doesn't owe us an explanation. So now the real question sets in. What are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about the fact that this is our reality and God owes us no explanation? I will say that I think it is unrealistic and not God's intention for us to get to this point and to just intellectually accept that this is our reality and then have no emotional reaction to it. He's not just shutting us down, okay? I don't think he's just shutting Job down. He's definitely humbling Job, but it's not like, well, I've explained it to you, and you're still upset? Why are you still upset about that? I don't think that's his intention. I don't think it's his intention for us to have no emotional reaction to this existence we're in. because he made us. And he knows that the knowledge of these things greatly affects our own sense of security and stability. Right? He knows that. He knows that when he tells us, I did things that don't make sense, and I don't have to tell you why, that can destabilize us a little bit, right? That can shake us a little bit. Like now we live in an existence where God does things that don't make sense to us, but he doesn't have to explain them. So what we choose to do with that reality, that these bad things are going to happen and that God owes us no explanation, it's up to us. We have a choice now what we want to do with it. One response is we decide we're going to hate God to the point of disbelief in his existence, which some people have done. Some people have said, I don't want to serve a God like that. So therefore, I don't think he exists. And then if he does, I still don't want to serve him. Another response is to hold to your faith and to believe that whatever this is, it's temporary, and to have trust in God that he will set it right one day, that things will be made right. And I keep going back to the book of Job because I think that that is going to be implicit all throughout this answer, that here God shows up. Did he have to show up? No. He didn't have to show up and talk with Job. When he showed up, could he have just struck Job dead because he's just tired of hearing Job talk? He didn't do that, though. He was there to persuade, and he was there to reason. He's presenting arguments for Job and his friends to consider because he wants to change their way of thinking about where they've gotten to. He is a God who wants to reason with them. And by showing up, as we talked about in chapter 38, God is proving that he is both willing and capable of holding evil and wrong to account. He's going to consider those things, and he's going to do something about them. And that's especially evident back in chapter 38. When we were looking at that, we talked about how the sun rises and it extends to the skirts of the earth. The idea that God sees the things that are happening in the darkness. He sees the evil, and he's doing something about it. Okay, so he shows up, he's reasoning with Job, and he's reaffirming to Job that he sees and he's doing. He will act. Okay, so those are two reactions we can have, and those are some of the reasons why we can react in faith instead of to just simply react in anger and turn our backs on God because these things happen. I will say this too, given those two reactions that we can have, I'll get you in 1 minute, brother. Given those two actions we have, I see that one of those reactions addresses the problem of anxiety while the other one does not. To put our faith in God addresses the problem of anxiety. If we believe that there is God and that he can and will make things right eventually, then I have hope. I have something to look forward to. If I turn my back on God and hate him, then what assurances do I have? I mean, if you want to talk about a horrific existence, think about one where there's no accountability for anything. And think about one where everybody's clinging to every little bit of good they can get their hands on because it's all they have to offset the evil that's coming their way. That's much, much worse. Much worse. Yes, John.
Where he can
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of us, for some of us, I think that's how we go about life, you know. But then you get confronted by Yahweh and his just infinite wisdom and power and understanding. How is he supposed to talk to me as somebody who is so much more limited than he is? It's like me trying to talk to an ant and convince an ant to pour me a glass of water. And so, really bad examples. Sorry.
I'm with you though, so I'm following you.
Yeah, so tell me what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, God obviously wasn't here to give a physics lecture, right? When he talks about how he created all these things, he's not talking over their head. He's addressing them at their level. He's using terms and concepts that they would understand and would mean something to them so that he could use those things as examples to make his points that he wanted them to get out of this. I think that to your point about Job's friends saying, like, hey, how's that going to work out for you? I think they were kind of right on, at least in their thinking on that. You know, we've talked throughout the class about how in each argument we've read up to this point, you can flesh out good and bad from those arguments, right? Some of the things they say are like right on, and some of the things they say are, you know, taken out of context. Just look at it in a vacuum and forget they're talking about Job and they have some wrong ideas about why Job is suffering. I would amen every word they say. And I think that some of that's playing out now. You know, I think it's evident if you jump over to chapter 42 in verses 5 and 6 when Job says, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. It got real. You know, Job had this idea in his head about how this exchange would go, and it's not going that way. And now that he's there and it's happening, he's seeing how foolish his expectation was and how outside of reality it really was. And I can relate to that on a much smaller scale. I haven't been in the presence of God face to face. But I have been in situations where I've built up how this exchange would go in my mind, and then I get there in reality, and it's like, I can't believe I was so immature as to think the conversation would go this way. Like all that preparation was for naught, right? It's not helping anything. So, I don't know. I hope that helps a little bit, or kind of answers it. Yeah, great points. And something that I think we ought to remember from our study from Job is, let's be a little more humble. Let's have a little more humility about what we profess to know. Let's just have some humility. Even if we're confident in some conclusion that we have, let's still have enough humility to hear the other side out. Yeah, Billy? Right.
And that's because he has a relationship with Job. The text specifically says in chapter 38, this part of the answer is for Job. He hasn't even turned himself to the other guys yet. So Job knows God, and God knows Job. And so when Job questions God, that's an assault on their relationship. God has proven himself first to Job. So that when these things occur, he feels that there's a responsibility that Job has to err towards God's side. Although, as we mentioned many times, I mean, this is a horrible situation. Tylenol, and I'm a kid still, so, you know, we had already, obviously, just, we knew what to give him, and he, you know, asked his doctor if he needed to or whatever, but he was smart enough to ask, well, now, what you're asking me to do doesn't seem quite right, and I would get very frustrated with him and say, at what point have we made you think that we're going to have you take medicine that would hurt you?
Yeah.
And we would have those discussions, and I think that's exactly what we're seeing here. With God's response is like, I mean, you know me, you know how I care for you. What's going on with these words you're throwing at me here?
Yeah, and we do find ourselves sometimes in the unfortunate position of having a question and not being ready for the answer, and as a parent to three kids, I've witnessed that. I've had my kids ask me questions that if I gave them the answer, they wouldn't understand the answer. Kelly, hold your thought 1 second. I want to hit on a couple things that these guys said, and I'll come back around to you. But you touched on some really good stuff. One of them is, I think we can see the effects that suffering can have on us and how they can shake our confidence in God. Because to your point, Billy, Job had a body of evidence up to the time when he started suffering that God was caring for him. And there was no doubt in his mind as to how these blessings were coming to him. But we see how that suffering eroded that confidence and kind of changed how Job viewed God. And, you know, it makes me think of John, when John Banks delivered the sermon several weeks ago when he talked about John the Baptist in prison. You know, sending his messengers asking, are you really the one? And when things aren't going our way, to your point, you know, it's easy for our faith to get shaken a little bit. Our confidence can get shaken. So, you know, one of the applications is let's prepare our minds as best we can to be ready that when we suffer, let's not let our confidence be shaken, but let's also not underestimate its effect. And let's deal with each other with as much care as God deals with Job, as we're about to see. And as much as Jesus demonstrated John. I mean, the soft answer that Jesus gave John when John was in prison, right? He didn't say, John, you've been with me all these years and you're saying this now, you know? He didn't go there. So one other thing is we were talking about responses to these things. And it's apparent that what God's going for here is fear and humility, right? I mean, he appears in a storm and he's throwing these questions at Job that Job has no hope of answering. And all that's putting Job in his place. So you have that fear and humility. But I think that what he's doing is, with that as the foundation, he's rebuilding trust and he's rebuilding faith. You know, again, I'll keep hitting this point, but you have a God here who's proving that he's capable and willing to judge right and wrong. He's setting the wrong things that Job and his friends said in order. He's fixing that problem. He's here to address that. So he's going to judge right and wrong. He's not going to leave that unfinished. That was one of the things Job was concerned about. That God, it didn't matter if you were righteous or not. That was one of Job's complaints. Same thing happens to them all. No, God's proving that's not the case here. And that's going to become even more apparent as we get into chapter 40. But if I'm looking at it from Job's perspective, again, here God has decided to reason with me rather than deal harshly with me. He's come to present arguments for me to consider. And, you know, later on, of course, we've got the greater narrative of the Bible, of the whole thing, and we can kind of see how a lot of these things fit together, and we start to learn more about the extent of the sacrifices that God makes for us, and more about how God's caring for us is revealed to us. And not all that was exactly evident in the book of Job. We've talked about that too, right? So a huge portion of God's personal sacrifice is veiled when we read the account of Job in isolation from the rest of the Bible. So, you know, my takeaway is I'm rooting for Job a little bit, but I think we need to learn these lessons, right? We don't want to become indignant about it, but man, I can sure empathize with Job. I feel really bad for that guy. I want to look at a couple of other things in chapter 39, but Kelly, you had a comment real quick.
Somebody goes through those intellectual steps and reasons that you outlined.
You know, one of the things that gives me a lot of security in the Bible and in accounts like Job is how self-aware it is of these challenges. And it meets them head on. I mean, God just throws it all out there and says, here's what you're going to be dealing with. You're going to be dealing with stuff that's not going to work out for you too well, and it's not going to make a lot of sense, and you're probably not going to get an answer from me on everything you want an answer for. So what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do with it? I don't see Scripture scrambling to answer those questions. I see them presenting them and saying, this is your reality. So what are you going to do with it? What's your response to that going to be? And let's challenge ourselves, why would we have the reaction, whatever it's going to be, why would we have the reaction that we have? What's motivating that? This stuff really challenges the core of, like, faith and I mean, just our very foundational things about our relationship with God. I mean, this is really, really foundational stuff that we can look at in the book of Job. I think just a couple of the things in chapter 39, you know how we talked in chapter 38, we have God addressing some examples of things that Job said previously. I think you have some of that happening here too. We're about out of time, but I would encourage you just go back and read chapter 24 again, and then read chapter 39, and you're going to see a lot of that imagery start to line up again. I see that as God kind of responding to Job's points that he was making and saying, well, if you don't really understand the example you're giving, you don't really understand the point you're making. So there's some of that too. So check out Job chapter 24, compare it to Job chapter 39. Next week, I guess we'll get into chapter 40. I think chapters 40 and 41 and 42 are going to go pretty quick. So I'm kind of expecting there's going to be two classes left. So we'll pick up back then. That'll be the plan. Thanks for your comments and your good attention this morning.